ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi there, I'm Sam Hawley, host of ABC News Daily. Our podcast covers one big news story each weekday in just 15 minutes. From history-changing world news to cost of living concerns at home, expert guests and ABC journalists explain what matters most. We cover breaking news and the big challenges of our time. Follow the ABC News Daily Podcast on ABC Listen.
House prices are falling across the country, with the downturn no longer just confined to Sydney and Melbourne. It's welcome news for those trying to enter the market, with Labor frontbencher Tanya Plibersek suggesting there's never been a better time to be a first home buyer. But of course, not everyone is happy. And as a two-day inquiry into Labor's gambling ad legislation gets underway, pressure is mounting on the Albanese government to go further and ban inducements. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Grieber.
Jacob, it's poll Monday, so we can't not go there.
Isn't it poll Monday every Monday? It feels
pretty much. It's meant to be every second, right, with the cadence of the polls. But yeah, increasingly now with the Redbridge poll also in the field. It's another poll, another day. So the Redbridge AFR poll taken from Monday to Thursday last week shows One Nation has edged back ahead of Labor on the primary vote. So they are the party that's most popular. Their primary vote increased 2% to 31%. Labor fell by 1% to 29%. It's all kind of, you know, to be truthful, very much edging all around each other, aren't they? They're all kind of up here, down, up, down. But we've spoken this many times, all the caveats should be there. But it does show a resilience around the One Nation vote, doesn't it?
It shows a resilience in, I suspect, the disgruntled, disappointed, angry voter vote, I suspect, is what that's showing. And they have been parked now with One Nation, I would say, really most of the year. It does bounce around a little bit, the final number, but these are folks who are not happy with the direction of the country. They're not happy with the major parties, and they are seeing something in One Nation that they like. That's my interpretation of it. And I think there's no reason now to doubt these polls and the accuracy of these polls. The bigger question, PK, is what do you think they look like when it comes to an election 18 months from now? That, to me, feels like a very different question to, are these polls real right now?
Yeah, that is a different question, but there's a kind of more short-term answer to that question, and that's in 4 months in Victoria, which is the petri dish, really, of how this might work. Bit different to South Australia, where, of course, we had a very popular Premier in Peter Malinauskas taking Labor to another landslide. So that's, you saw some evidence of the way people are thinking about One Nation, which showed them being popular still, I think, to be fair. But it's not the same as what we're about to see in Victoria. So today, Pauline Hanson has unveiled Victorian upper house candidates, kind of continuing her march. So she's been in Melbourne doing that. Her chief of staff, James Ashby, is also confirmed to be stepping up to become the One Nation National Director. I think this is really significant because he's obviously been kind of the brains behind her office's operation. Now he's taking it to the next level, nationally coordinating, so playing the same role that perhaps Paul Erickson plays for the Labor Party, or there's a new guy, isn't there, that's taken over from Andrew Hirst in the Liberal Party. But my point is, like, that role, playing that role for a party is kind of coordinating its national seat approach, and you need that if you're going to be a serious contender,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, look, it's a sign, isn't it, that they're trying to quote-unquote professionalise the outfit so that you have someone who's responsible for raising money for the campaign and making decisions about where and how that money gets spent, someone who's responsible for vetting, frankly, hundreds of candidates when you think about the fact they're running across federal and state jurisdictions. That's a lot of work. There's a lot of people to look into. You might have pre-selections in some seats where you have quite a large number of people wanting to be the One Nation candidate. So it's actually quite a lot of work, and that's now what they seem to be saying. They're dedicating Ashby's powers to this job.
They are giving him a pretty serious and powerful role in really going hard to be a main contender. Scott Morrison's senior staffer, Chris Taylor, is going to take the role of chief of staff in Pauline Hanson's office. Again, that tells you everything you need to know about the sort of slow burn of either as candidates or as backroom operators. Even James Ashby was once LNP. These people who used to be on the traditional centre-right of politics, the coalition, either Nationals or Liberals, going and defecting to One Nation. Don't you think that is a significant get, right? Somebody who worked for a former Prime Minister now running Pauline Hanson's office. That a, speaks
a former
volumes,
Prime Minister, PK,
it?
Yeah. And also, look, someone who was probably, I don't know this person particularly well, but looking at the jobs that they've held, they've been for more moderate Liberals, actually. Scott Morrison, maybe he's a moderate, maybe he's not, in the factional sort of nuance of New South Wales. But he also worked for Simon Birmingham at the, you know, the Australian Bankers Association as a policy person. So perhaps from a more unexpected end of the conservative political spectrum, now working for One Nation. I think you're right, PK. These are the little signs that that's where the you know, the brain power is going.
It's a sign of the increasing professionalisation of One Nation as well, which is what you need if you want to be competitive with major parties in a big major election at the next federal election and, you know, as I say, the next test case being Victoria, where there was a lot of disruption, a very old Labor government after 12 years that changed Premier, as we discussed a lot last week, you know, a real opportunity for One Nation to make inroads. And so today's polling, I reckon, in the Pauline Hanson office, this is, I'm making an announcement now, this is speculation, but my speculation is they would have thought, ha, you know, all of the negative stories about her trip to Sicily with Gina Rinehart, all of the negative stories about her trip to the UK, Tommy Robinson, all of the
stuff
reporting.
Stuff about Barnaby yelling at the dog on 7:30, all of those.
The dog I always thought was potentially a poll bounce, by the way, and the opposite of it. I did. I just thought, you know, that was something that suited him.
So what are we looking at here? That you've just identified a whole bunch of really negative headlines and storylines that we heard about for a week or two as Pauline travelled, hung out, as you say, with some pretty dubious characters. We've since learnt that her trip to Italy was paid for by a billionaire. All of those things are true, yet they get a poll bounce. So what's going on here? Is it to me, this is a bit of a thing that you used to see with Donald Trump. There was no negative headline that could hurt him.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So it just demonstrates that all of the traditional ways that opponents, you know, political competitors would try to dismantle or hurt a political leader or party don't work on Pauline Hanson. And as you say, didn't work on Donald Trump. Now, one caveat on this, perhaps they are working and we're not seeing it about further growing her vote, yeah? Like getting it beyond where it's peaked. Perhaps it is making some people who are thinking of One Nation think twice. We don't know that because if anything, there's a plateauing of the vote but at a high watermark for a once minor party. And for that cohort, their interest in One Nation and Pauline Hanson goes way beyond any bad or negative story. It is, they like the concept of One Nation and they're going to keep parking there, whether it be real or just parking until a vote happens, we're not sure. But it's not going to budge them. And perhaps, going to add this, the sort of feeling of a pile on has even maybe benefited her, you know, when there's a lot of feverish reporting around someone that perhaps looks maybe unfair. I'm not saying it was unfair. I think scrutiny of any politician is fair personally. But if it has that look of a stacks on, sometimes it can backfire. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That the diehards will always take grievance from media coverage, but I've also never met a political leader who loves all of the media coverage all the time. They all complain about it.
Oh, that's
they all say it's unfair at some point in the cycle, but it can have that effect of galvanizing a political base if there's seen to be unfairness in it. So I think you're right. That's part of why she's still got gets this 30% primary number. That's the locked on, or a big chunk of that is the locked on vote. And then the softer vote that feels sorry for her or who actually doesn't care what the critics say.
Yeah. It's just noise. Yeah. Also, the idea of cause and effect we should challenge as well.
Sure.
Like we often think what happened that week is if everyone is, you know,
watching
pouring
the same
over
feeds and the same thing.
Every headline trying to work out how they feel, whereas these are longer term impressions that you find in those sorts of surveys, you know, that people have come to, and this is the longer term impression people are coming to.
I think that's right. And then the sort of the Victorian thing's going to be really interesting, isn't it? The thing I'm watching there, and you're better placed given you are in Melbourne most of the time, is does the Liberal Party's campaign in Victoria for obviously the state election, does that do enough? Does that give voters enough to pull them away from One Nation? Because if that were to happen, if Jess Wilson were to sort of lift in the polls, it would probably be at the expense of One Nation support, quite a bit of it. And I think that's a really interesting prospect, because that would suggest that if the Liberals offer somebody who is seen to be viable or seen to be able to challenge the incumbent government, in this case Labor, which is it's been around for a while now, it's got lots of problems, we've talked about them. There's voters who've been unhappy with Labor for a while, but they haven't felt the Liberal Party in Victoria's really got its act together. If the Liberal Party is seen to have its act together, do they pull those votes away from One Nation? What do you think? I mean, to me, that feels like really the test of this election in the next few months.
Well, that is actually I don't have an answer. Only the question of watching that, right? Like, where do they take them? Where are we going to see those swings? I just think it's worth looking. Last comment before we move on to some other federal issues, but on the Victorian map, right? A lot of the paint that came off the Dan Andrews government at the last election was in, for instance, the western suburbs of Melbourne, working class voters who were pretty cranky, who were traditional Labor voters. And those voters, it seems, would be very interested. That's where you will see a very clear One Nation Labor fight, yeah? And then in the regions, it's probably more Labor One Nation, Liberal One, LNP One Nation, right? So I just think you're going to see some really surprising things in that election, which is why everyone's obsessed with it. Well, I am, and I know all political junkies are obsessed with it. I just think we're going to see some unexpected results, and all of this stuff, and I've been part of it, so I'm putting my hand up here, but you know that Pauline Hanson doesn't have a leader in Victoria, blah, 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 that this is going to come back to bite her. I'm not sure it is, actually.
No, the leader. I mean, she's the figurehead. She's the thing that draws people's attention and attracts her supporters. I don't think it matters, quite frankly, who the leader is in Victoria.
I'm going to add something even more controversial. Perhaps it's helpful not to have one, right? Perhaps.
Perhaps, yeah.
Perhaps not being in the limelight, not answering questions every day is of benefit. Look, just final comment. Sadly, and I will say sadly because I think it's a very sad thing, that the ABC was not allowed to go to Pauline Hanson's launch of her candidates today in Victoria. I think it's very sad because I think everyone should just be able to go and cover an event, especially of a party that wants to or claims to want to form government. We should be allowed to be there. And you were actually watching it on Sky News, weren't you? Because, of course, they're allowed to take it.
You can't call it Sky News anymore, PK. Oh.
What's going to happen? Do I get
News
arrested?
24. News 24.
Do 24? I get arrested?
I don't know. I don't know what happens if you get it wrong.
Now, I'm going to give you this information. Reporters from the ABC, The Age and The Guardian were not provided with the time or location of the press conference. So it wasn't just the ABC.
Yeah, well, that's a big audience when you combine all of that. And the ABC audience in Victoria goes to regional areas. So, yeah, I don't know. The logic of this is obviously to stoke the notion that there's a grievance against certain media organisations. I'm sure that plays quite well for some of her supporters. But to win, to seriously win, you need to expand. You need to expand your support. And cutting out large chunks of the media seems like a strange way of doing it.
It's also, for me, always evidence of confidence. Like when Pauline Hanson fronted the National Press Club and took questions, I actually thought that demonstrated her confidence. Yeah, like I can take you on. So even if she believes that all these people are out to get her, right? Let's just say her thesis is correct. I don't believe it is, but let's say it is, right? I just think as a sort of power play to go, come ask me. Like, I just think there is nothing stronger for a leader. And I find that strange too. I would just let everyone in, open the door and say, hey, yeah, I'm at the top of the pops,
bring it,
mate.
Bring it.
I'm at the top of the pops.
Yep.
Look, I want to dramatically pivot to something else. The housing market and its downturn has spread beyond Sydney and Melbourne. Now, of course, just to caveat on that, Sydney and Melbourne are still leading the downturn. Cotality found national property prices in July fell 0.7%, the largest single monthly decline in value since December 2022, Brisbane and Adelaide falling by 0.6% and 0.2% respectively. Government is sticking by Treasury forecasts that house price growth would slow by around 2%. So that's the growth, remember. It's not like drop. It's about the growth. Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek has been speaking, so has the Treasurer. She told Sunrise that there's never been a better time to buy a first home. But, Jacob, is it all good?
With that kind of a sales pitch.
Is it all fine?
With that kind of a sales pitch, get out there, fill your boots.
Never been a better time.
Never been a better time. Yeah, that's the old, that's such a real estate agent's line, isn't it? That will always depend on a person's personal circumstances, won't it? Whether it's the great time to buy. So there's been a 0.7% decline, as you said. The median value of a house is still $928,421. So that's not that far off $1 million. And it's $220,000 above where it was just not even 4 years ago. So keep it in perspective, I suspect, is one of the messages the government would like to get out but hasn't been able to sort of say too explicitly, because prices are coming down, but they are still way above where they were a few years ago, and especially relative to income and relative to the ability of people to save deposits. So this is it's you know, we still have some of the most expensive property in the world, and it's come down a bit. I'm sure people will jump up and down who maybe bought very recently or extract a lot of equity from their house to pay for consumption and other factors in life. So that may not be so easy to do now. But I mean, the problem here is one that has been allowed to get worse over decades. This is the start of a pretty big policy change. It's going to take a while for us to see what the actual outcome is. And the goal, I think everyone forgets, is to get more younger people into buying homes, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That goal happens at the same time as other parts of the market are also affected, Jacob. And that's where it gets prickly and tricky for the government. Their view is they can withstand any pressure from it. Is that the case, or is this now becoming a deeper problem?
Well, it depends on how they explain what's happening here. I do think it's foolish for them to focus too much on Treasury modelling, because that's notoriously, the nature of these things is very difficult to model. The 2% reduced growth rate, I suspect, won't look very good in a few months' time when there's been outright declines across the board. But I think in the detail of the market is interesting. The price declines seem to be strongest in the upper ends of the property market. So the more expensive properties, the trophy end of the market, which is where wealthy people will park their wealth. But at the bottom end, the numbers actually show there's been a slight increase in market values, because that's the end of the market that first home buyers are focused on. That's what they can afford. And there's still a very large demand for affordable first homes for people out there. So that's interesting to me that it hasn't hit the end of the market, I'd call the bit that's what we're all talking about, which is the intergenerational fairness of people not being able to get into the market. The fact that a few really, really high-end properties have fallen sharply, I mean, I think the world will probably survive that, wouldn't they?
I love it when you say this is a man who calls a spade a spade. I think the world will survive it. I think there are, you know, but I think it puts the pressure on labour. That thing you just mentioned, that at the bottom end, that hasn't been the decrease. That's the point that the shadow treasurer is making, and I think it's a powerful one, isn't it?
Well, right? See the problem there, and the problem with the bottom end, or not bottom end, but the affordable end of the market, is that's where there's still not enough supply to actually satisfy that market. And one of the problems here, and this I suspect this might be what the opposition's getting at, but if you do tank investor confidence in the property market, and people keep waking up now to read headlines that the auction clearance rate has collapsed on Saturday yet again, and prices are heading down. The effect of that, and we can see it in the data, is that there are fewer properties listed, because people, if they don't actually have to sell, don't sell. Why would you sell into this market if you had a choice? And so that might be hurting first home buyers' options. You know, there's fewer properties on the market than there were 6 months ago. So that's going to be a real problem to watch as well.
Yeah, a lot to watch. And you can see the government kind of managing it, making their arguments, but feeling, you know, probably a little bit under pressure on how sustained it is, how long, because it leads to a kind of perception of confidence in the economy. That's the other part, isn't it?
And that's very low. I mean, the data there around consumer confidence is very, very low.
Very low. Okay. Gambling reform, that's on the agenda again. The Senate inquiry into Labor's gambling ad legislation has started. It's a two-day inquiry set to hear from harm reduction advocates, medical experts, those with lived experience. Already, Luke Bateman, an ex-NRL player and anti-gambling advocate, has called for an end to inducements. He said he had losses of tens of thousands of dollars a month at the peak of his problem. And I suppose all of that alleged gambling company employees offering him drugs.
I mean, that's an extraordinary story, isn't it?
It's not a small thing, is it?
Yeah. I mean, what he's saying there is that he was someone with a serious problem, and then they were adding to that with inducements of this kind. Extraordinary, extraordinary. So that's, yeah, there's been a lot of attention on that here in Canberra in Parliament House this morning, because it is so startling, and he's you know, quite a well-known person as well.
He is. Inducements are going to be difficult, I think, to ignore. Already the minister responsible, Annika Wells, has pointed to bet stop this morning, self-registered exclusion. Now, the problem with that is the hint is in the title, isn't it? Self-registered.
Yeah. Or you could push a button to somehow turn the inducements off. I don't know. I feel like that should be a button on the vending machine outside my office here for the M&M packets, because at about 3 o'clock, I find it very hard not to be induced into buying M&Ms, even though I know they're not good for me. Yeah. But yeah, there's no button to
no, there's no in the M&M button.
In seriousness, though, that seems like there's much more work to be done there, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
you're talking about people who have an addiction problem, and you're asking them to somehow be able to, in the depth of that, judge that they need to get out of it. And of course, the individual does carry a big, big responsibility in all of this, and that's at the core of this debate. But inducements are, and it's in the name, as you said.
Yep, it is. The government doesn't obviously want to give a lot on this. So watch that space on the coalition, all of those coalition backbenchers that want tougher regulation. Hopefully, we will see some really interesting parliamentary negotiation here, because that's the parliament at its best. This is just 2 days of an inquiry. It's not until the pointy end where if the government's going down the road of the coalition to get this through, because I think the Greens are much more tough line on it, then they might have to give. Labor's policy platform was updated to recognise the harm caused by online betting inducements, pledging to strengthen existing federal powers. That probably puts a little bit of pressure, not probably enough, it was vague enough, but a little bit of pressure maybe on the government to think about the way they frame this. Let's see.
It just doesn't go away, this issue, in its current status quo, does it? It just doesn't go away.
No, and the menace to the community doesn't go away. The people affected are so often, not exclusively, they're across the board, but, you know, one of the things you hear from Labor people who are passionate about this is these are our constituents, you know, we have to do more. And I think that's a powerful argument. Look, just finally before we go, Garma happened over the weekend. It's kind of premier Indigenous festival in this country, in Arnhem Land. The PM didn't attend for the first time. He said he needed a break. It's first break he's had this year, so he's off at the moment for a brief period of time. Parliament's back next week. Noel Pearson, who I think is, you know, considered one of the best and most sort of powerful Indigenous leaders in the country, used an emotional address to call for action. Despite the failure of The Voice, he laid out a vision to centralise Indigenous policy at the federal level, remove state and territory Indigenous departments. I get why he's frustrated. If you look at some of the state and territory Indigenous departments, and you need not look further, Jacob, than the Northern Territory, that is demonstrably on the figures failing Aboriginal people, on the figures. It is irrefutable. So you can see the frustration of Indigenous leaders who can see the hardcore facts proving that Aboriginal people are going backwards. Julian Lisa, who's the opposition spokesperson, a very passionate Indigenous affairs, you know, advocate, has been, you know, broke ranks, sat on the backbench on The Voice. He says the government is adrift on Indigenous policy post-Voice. I think that you could definitely fact check that. I think there's been incrementalism of the highest order since The Voice loss. He says Australians want us to get on with the practical and not necessary look at the structural at this time. That's in relation to Noel Pearson's proposal. Now, I'm just going to add, from someone who's watched this for a long time, I don't know if that's what Australians told us in that vote. I don't think they told us they didn't want to look at the structural. I think they told us they didn't want a voice in the constitution, a very specific thing they said no to. They didn't say no to all structural change, because structures do matter. So just, you know.
Yeah, I confess this is not an area I've done a lot of reporting on, but the practical does come from structural. I mean, that's to say that one should be excluded the other. And I don't know that that's what Julian Lisa's saying, but if the structures are not right, and that's very different to saying we need a voice or shouldn't have a voice. We're talking about the way services are delivered, the way money's deployed. And as you said, the numbers and the data is showing it's not improving. Well, then you do need a structural discussion. I think that's what Noel Pearson's arguing, isn't he?
I think he wants some big seismic change. The problem, though, is there is zero interest, as far as I can record it, from the federal government that would have to engage in that to put pressure on the state governments and, of course, the territory to do it. I can't see that pressure. They have said that they want to look at some, you know, they're willing to look at issues around funding for the NT, for instance, but it's all just words. I haven't seen any evidence that they're willing to have a fight on this and do something substantive. And so I don't think anything's going to happen.
That's a bleak assessment, PK.
That's how I see it. I've watched the words. I see no fire in the belly of the Prime Minister on trying to kind of intervene and do something on incarceration, on any of these issues. I just don't. I think he thinks that's outside of his direct remit. Obviously, crime is very much a state-territory issue. In the case of the territory, though, the federal government has enormous power, but I don't see him having any appetite to use that power. That's how I see it. When I see evidence to say something different, I'll say it, but I can see no evidence. Look, I want to end the pod with just to mention that the government hasn't yet stood federal MP for Solomon Luke Gosling down from his special envoy position. Comes after he was charged with two counts of assault following an alleged incident involving Northern Territory Administrator David Connolly, which he denies. Yesterday, Health Minister Mark Butler said the role of special envoy wasn't ministerial and therefore it wasn't necessary. What do you think?
I think that's a very lame response. Quite frankly, this is still a position that's been, you know, it exists, it elevates someone from the backbench. It means they have responsibilities. We don't know where this goes in terms of the legal process, but I think it would be a, it's quite surprising that he's been allowed to keep that role and hasn't been, you know, at the very least, had it suspended until this is all cleared up. I think that would have been a reasonable person's assumption of what should happen. So very, very surprising. I suspect it hasn't happened because the government hasn't had any minister kind of taken out in this way. They've never, you know, the Prime Minister likes the fact that all of his ministry have gone through their term, have, you know, been orderly. There haven't been sackings, there haven't been stepping down type events. So he doesn't want to break that record, but I don't think it's a good look in this instance. And we, you know, we'll find out. This will eventually be resolved one way or the other. We're not casting judgment on any of the characters here, but I think in this type of circumstances, given the type of a charge that's involved here, it's very surprising that he's kept that role.
Yeah, I agree. And you can say, you know, he's innocent, as he's arguing. You can say, as his lawyer has said, that he believes it's politically motivated. That's what he's alleging, Luke Gosling. You can say all that and still stand down to go through the process because we believe in the rule of law, right?
And if the position isn't that important, as Butler sort of seems to have implied, well, then stand him down, you know?
Yeah. One more thing just to note, and we will get into this more this week because I think we must, but we have got H5 bird flu now as a pretty significant event in our country. Environment Minister Murray Watt, we're recording this on Monday morning-ish or the middle of the day Monday, he's just done a press conference. He says the mass mortality event in South Australia is likely the start of what he's called a long, difficult journey with bird flu. He says Australia has over the last 2 to 3 years tried to build up the resilience over our native populations to deal with this. And they've triggered the release of a $24 million package to try and get ahead of it. We'll talk about it more this week because I think it's a very important issue, not just because it's just obviously important, but I think it's alarming a lot of people. There's obviously the risk to poultry, the government saying, you know, they feel like it hasn't gotten into any of our poultry. And of course, that's the way we'd like it to stay. But on the just the environmental carnage and the devastation we might be witnessing over coming months and years, it might be pretty bad. So Jacob just wanted to note it because it's not a small thing, and I know lots of people are really worried about it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's a very depressing thought, actually.
God, we've left this on a dark note.
We've left people on a down note, but I mean, I think this one is one is not a We've always benefited from being sort of quarantined from some of these global things, haven't we? When it comes to, you know, foot and mouth or any of the stuff in agriculture that have devastated other countries, we've sort of always been able to avoid it. But this one does have that look of something building, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. All those dead birds, very sad. That's it for Politics Now today. Jacob, thank you.
My pleasure.
If you have a question for us, please send a short note to theparty room at abc.net.au. Fran and I will try and answer it. See you later.